This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science Lecture Series. My name is Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the Executive Director here at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps.
And it's a great pleasure to have you all this evening. And now I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Hubert Stadigal. Dr. Stadigal is a senior research geophysicist here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And he completed his undergraduate studies in mineralogy and petrology in Germany. And then he went on to do his PhD in volcanology, which he did most of that field work was, in fact, in the U.S. at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and at Lamont-Doherty Geological Observatory. And then he came to Scripps from Lamont in 1983. And then in 1991, he left Scripps, and he became the director of the Dutch National Laboratory for Isotope Geology and full professor in isotope geochemistry and igneous petrology at the Free University of Amsterdam. And then in 1996, he came back to Scripps. And we're very pleased that he's here. And his scientific interests aim broadly are to do with volcanoes, especially how volcanoes work, exploring the impact of their geochemistry on the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, the biosphere. And his recent work has focused in particular on seamount biogeosciences and the interaction of microbes with volcanic rocks. And in addition, he also works with paleomagnetists, actually understanding the magnetic properties in volcanic rocks and how that helps to understand the magnetic field of the Earth. And something that some of those of you who already know Dr. Hubert Stadigal may not be so aware of is that he also does a lot of outreach here in San Diego. He works with the San Diego Unified School District, teaching communication and helping graduate students translate their work into their research, into the high school and middle schools in the area. Very cool work. And before I introduce Dr. Hubert Stadigal, I just want to say that the kind of work that he does, especially the field work he does, not only you have to be a really good scientist to do it, I think you have to have a sense of adventure and a sense of exploration. And quite frankly, I think you have to be really brave to do the kind of work he does. So, at that, please join me in introducing Dr. Hubert Stadigal tonight. Thank you.
Hello. Nigella, thank you very much for this introduction, and I'm brave enough to speak in front of you today. So let me just start this here. So what I want to talk to you about today is my work in Antarctica, which is a five-year program that started 4 years ago and is just about to end. And I talked about this program before, like 3 or 4 years ago, which was just the beginning of the program. So I will not repeat all the stuff that I said then, even though there will be some repetition. And instead, I will really focus on the field work that we have done this year, or last season, which is the 12-13 Austral summer, and focus on the diving and the work in the ice caves. So let me give you a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. First, I want to give you an understanding of why we are getting into this program at all, and how we find microbial traces in the in volcanic rocks in the geological record. Then we followed this up with trying to find this microbial life in actual seafloor volcanoes, in the hydrothermal systems, in active volcanoes. Then from there, developed the need that we had to go to Antarctica and tell you why we're doing that. About the field report, we're focusing on the dry valleys, the diving and the ice cave works on Erebus, and in the end I will give you some idea of the first microbiology results that we are getting. So let me explain you first something about volcanic glass. Volcanic glass, like the glass that you see in the window panes, is a material that started as a silicate melt that you cool so fast that crystals are not allowed to form. And if you would take these window panes and cool them slowly, they would be milky and crystalline. You couldn't look through it. Very different substance. Same thing in volcanoes. And this material is important for several reasons. It's very abundant. Okay. So if you go into the sediments, you drill cores into the Pacific Ocean, and you'll find that about 20%, that's a very large number, 20% of all sediments is volcanic ash, mostly volcanic glass. If you go deeper into the oceanic crust, the volcanic part is about 20% volcanic glass. And you probably remember a few years ago when Iceland's Eyjafjallajökull erupted, it showered all of Europe in ash. Right, so the air traffic was paralyzed during that time. So that's deposited everywhere, so it's very common. But in addition to that, volcanic glass is chemically unstable in presence of water. So if you put it in the hydrosphere, it wants to react with the water. So now volcanic rocks have energy and nutrients in them that is relatively easily freed up just by this hydration with water, and then this glass can provide this energy and nutrients to microbes. And that includes in particular the energy from redox reaction. The glass is very reduced, like the interior of the Earth is very reduced. And so there's 10% iron, most of it is reducing. Manganese, sulfur, hydrogen, all these elements can be reduced by microbes and used for carbon fixation. There's abundant macronutrients, phosphorus, sulfur, potassium, calcium, iron, magnesium, and micronutrients, silica, sodium, cobalt, zinc, and molybdenum. And then what's really beautiful about the volcanic glass is that we can study it in the geological record. And that volcanic glass in the geological record has actually traces of this microbial interaction with the glass. So we can actually in situ, in place, in these volcanoes, look at how microbes eat this material. And from the textures that we observe, ideally we can deduce what kind of microbes they are and how they have to do this. So let me show you one example of such trace fossils. All these slides are either scanning electron microscope pictures or optical microscope pictures of a very thin slice of glass, and you see a scale in all of those. And each one of those pictures has a line in it, which is a crack, along which water can enter the rock, and with it, the microbes. So we interpret these are little holes, micron-sized holes. We interpret those as places where microbes drilled or bored into the glass and made themselves a little home. Now, if you go a scale up, then you can see that these little spheres turn into sort of somewhat of a granular texture that almost looks like a growth in an agar plate. Those things can coalesce and finally form a whole layer along one of those cracks. And another type of alteration that we call tubular alteration is very distinct. So you have these tubes. There's about a micron thick, 100 microns long, and in this particular case, you have a secondary tube spiraling around this. So we have been attacked in the community by saying that people cannot imagine that microbes do this. I argue here is that this kind of thing just cannot be done abiotically. So that's a very strong textural argument why those things are done by microbes. Now, once we worked on this, we figured out, well, maybe this is all, we find this in rocks from the seafloor, from ophiolites, up to like 150 million years. So we wondering how back in time can we see those things. So we go to these really old greenstone belts in Australia and in South Africa and look there for those features. And the top two are from the Euro Formation in the Pilbara in Australia, and the bottom two are from the Barberton in South Africa. Now, in these very old rocks, they're 3.5 billion years old. The Earth is 4.5 billion, so it's almost as old as the Earth. You don't have any glass left, but you have very fine-grained and green chlorite that replaces the glass. And if you start with this diagram, you see that there's this shape here, which is like a shard of volcanic glass embedded in chlorite. And then you see these black linings, and then if you blow this place up, you find these minerals, titanite, that have the same morphology as we have seen this in the holes in the much younger geological record. So those processes have been around for billions of years. So how do we imagine that working? And so just in a schematic drawing, I mean, we have some fresh glass, we have water, and a cell wants to colonize the surface, attaches it, and as it has a metabolic processes going on, it often produces acids. This acid will dramatically change the pH at the contact area where it's not immediately diluted by the water. The glass starts dissolving, and the cell basically works its way into the glass while dissolving the glass and then having these minerals drop out as soon as the pH changes, as it sort of leaves that narrow spot. You do one after another, and you get this granular texture that I showed you earlier. If you and this process actually has been observed in fungi, is that if you have a cell extension like a hyphae or pili in bacteria, they actually can excrete acids at the tip of these hyphae and then actually drill into this. And this process has been seen in soils where the hyphae of fungi are capable of actually penetrating into through toxic layers and to get at the nutrients. So barriers like this, these alteration phases, are meaningless for these hyphae type things. They can drill through and still get to the material in this volcanic glass. Now let me just in short sentences explain what we have done so far on the microbiology, and that is Brad Thiebaud and Laurie Connell's work. So we went to seamounts in the Pacific, Luis Seamount of Hawaii and Vailulu Seamount of Samoa, and we harvested microbes from surfaces from these volcanoes. So we find many of them. And we have now in culture close to 100 of the different types, and they are capable of oxidizing iron, manganese. They're producing chelators, which are chemicals that you need to cycle iron. But if you test them for whether they can also eat sugar or organics, they all do. Almost all of them do. So the question is, we have in these communities, we have microbes that are multitaskers. And they are chemolithotrophs, which means they eat chemical energy to fix carbon. And they're heterotrophs, that means they eat organic to fix carbon. And so being a multitasker, is that just a clever trick that allows you to survive in many different situations? Or is it that only the microbes that can digest organics win in this environment because organics are a much more efficient fuel source? Are they outcompeting the guys who can only do the chemolithotrophy? So we decided to answer this question, whether that's just an adaptation mechanism or the survival of the most efficient microbe in this setting. So we looked very hard for an environment that just forces these chemolithotrophic reactions. So we need something that doesn't have any light, and we need something that doesn't get any organics, and where we have lots of volcanic glass. And that is Antarctica. So here we go, Antarctica. Just a little geography lesson. This is the meridian, zero. East Antarctica is in the eastern half. West Antarctica is in the western half. The transantarctic mountains separate Antarctica into two distinct physiographic features, the big shield and then the more mountainous and then shallow West Antarctica. Just to translate this in latitudes to the northern hemisphere, So the peninsula goes well beyond the Antarctic Circle. So when you go to the northernmost point in Alaska, you will be roughly at this latitude. And if you go to the northernmost point in Europe, you come to about this latitude, right? So this is actually quite a bit north. Now, I'll take you to our survey area down here in McMurdo, near the Ross Ice Shelf, neighboring to New Zealand down here. That's how we get there. We come from New Zealand to McMurdo. And it's right next to the Transantarctic Mountains. And here's sort of the outline of a map that I'm going to show you. And so we're looking east. This is the section of the Transantarctic Mountains that's called the Royal Society Range. And here is Ross Island. And then the Ross Ice Shelf comes down here. And the darker gray is the ocean that seasonally thaws and freezes. And then this is all area that is permanently frozen, even though it's not quite as thick as the ice shelf itself. I'm going to show you results from our fieldwork in Taylor Valley in Lake Frixel. Mount Erebus is the central and tallest mountain of Ross Island. And then I show you a lot of stuff in this area. We have experiments in the subsea ice conditions at Cape Evans. And then we dive pretty much in this whole area. This is the Erebus Glacier Tongue. That is a glacier coming down from Erebus and protruding into the ocean. There are the Delbridge Islands, and I'll show you some slides from there. And then there's a lot of work going on that we have done near McMurdo Station. So let's go to the Taylor Valley first. That's a view from Taylor Valley from the easternmost point looking west. And then this flat spot here is Lake Frixel. And I just want to give you a blow up of these typical glaciers that we see in Taylor Valley, and they always have these very steep flow fronts. That's a very typical glacier for Antarctica, where the bottom of the glacier is actually frozen to the ground. It's stuck to the ground. It doesn't move. Northern glaciers sort of scrape along and push the ice out. So these glaciers will have to move. They move the fastest on the top and the least on the bottom. So as this pushes on, and then in the summer melt, the water comes down, and then it makes these characteristic grooved near vertical cliffs of these glaciers, very characteristic for the dry valleys. Okay, this is the Commonwealth Glacier, which is the western end of Lake Frixel, viewed from our camp. This is our helicopter landing site. And you see that there's relatively smooth ice near the shore and very rough ice in the center, and that is because that always melts in the summer, in the Austral summer. And so you want to, when you work there, you want to work there before this melts, because it's a pain to get there if it's molten. So now, in 5 years ago, we had to drill a hole for a mooring that we put into the lake. And that sounds like a silly way to drill, but this is an auger drill. It's like an 8-inch drill bit. And what happens is that we have a very thick layer of ice. And that ice is really, really cold, like minus 50, minus 60 degrees. And as you're grinding, you're making this into a very fine powder that is at minus 60 degrees. And then when you poke through, water at freezing comes in. And then that, if you don't watch out, will flash freeze this really cold powder, and your drill bit is stuck. So, and then you have to melt it out. So what you end up doing is that you drill, and while you're drilling, you just move this drill bit up and down and up and down, up and down. So you expel these shavings all the time. So you keep it nice and clean. And so this is the hero's picture with a total drill bit that we used. So it was about 6 meters at the time. So this is the mooring that we put out. We start out with a weight to keep it vertical. And then we have these sample chambers where we put various substrates out that are specific, have more iron, more manganese, more phosphorus, and so on, hoping to attract particular microbes to digest these materials. Three different depths at three different oxidation states in the water column. So that's our nice nice round hole that we lower our charges in. And then when we're done, we just tie the mooring to a pallet and go away and let it freeze in. So that's the way we found it. That's good that we found it. And now, how do we get it out? Are we going to drill with the auger drill and basically sever the line and let it just drop back down? No, we have to melt it. And that is a pain in the butt. So here is a coil through which we can pump hot glycol, which is heated in this furnace type thing in a pump, and it circulates through and we melt our way in. You need a lot of fuel. So, but that's what helicopters are for, that fly it in and it's there when you go there and you start working. Then the weather changes. And it's beautiful weather. And actually, I should go back. Just note that everything is frozen, right? No water in sight. And then we started melting the ice. And we have all these lakes. We ended up having to jack up this kind of situation that we had almost like a drill island on top of this lake on top of the ice, and it was kind of interesting to control that drilling. But in the end, once you drill through, the lake drains. That's a great feeling when you in this water and all of a sudden, ooh, all this water goes down and then yes, I've done it. Now we can get to our materials, and here we are having pulled our charges out, and then we archive them. So between dry valleys and McMurdo, there are lots of penguins. So these are emperor penguins. They're really, really pretty, but they just sort of sit there and look, you know, at each other or, you know, sometimes in the same direction and just sit there. And then, you know, at times they check out the most modern hardware and see how that works. And then what they like the best is if they have three PhD paparazzi to make them feel royal. But still, they're just sitting there, you know, just being royal. Now, the Adelie penguins are a different story altogether. They just walk around, they're lively, they flutter their wings, they chat, and I mean, they're just kind of doing things, and here they wave at me and go on. They're just a lot of fun. They're moving about much. And note that they're all really clean on the ice. We'll find out later. So this guy obviously has some important thing to do, and he has to go back to the rookery. The rookery is really a big pile of guano. And so the penguins are often not the cleanest as they're practicing or doing their husbandry. So this year, there were a good number of eggs that were abandoned. We don't know why, but as soon as an egg is not paid attention to, they freeze and that's it for the, and so they never come back. So here, sunny side up, you can have a penguin egg. But they do hatch at times, and so these are some young chicks. Always nearby are the skuas, which are a giant, super-sized seagull that is really aggressive. And particularly when you come close to their hatchery, they sort of go after you. So in volleys of two in this case. And this guy, you know, just was like, you know, that's far away from my lens. And the only thing you can do is hold your hands up or your walking stick, or so otherwise they peck you on the head. Not very pleasant. 22nd of October, last sunset in McMurdo. So that's the last day. The sun disappeared behind the horizon, and then it doesn't come go back down until late February, March. Seals are always a favorite. This guy is the youngest seal that I've ever seen. It's probably just a few hours old when I took the photos. And we still saw the placenta sort of next to him. And so they're pretty cute from earliest age. And they become pretty bulky very quickly. frisky. And here's one coming out of the water. I'll show you some pictures from underneath, and then you will know how silly it was to stand there and taking the photos. Sorry to the ones who have seen that picture before, but that's like a really big seal. And but we ignored to photograph it such that you could actually see how big it is. So we decided in Photoshop we just put a scale right next to it, so you have an idea of the experiences that we had in Antarctica. So this is Falcon Scott's hut. In the background is Mount Erebus. And I just want to show you some pictures from within the hut. I ended up being a hut guide, so I get the keys and I can show people. So that's the pantry. And the Antarctic Heritage Society from New Zealand takes care of those things. Sleeping quarters. And a lab. And that's the pony stable. They had ponies. Not a very smart decision, but they had ponies. I walked to the end of the stable, and then I saw this poor old dog still with his collar on and chained. Kind of, they must have left in a hurry, not really thinking much about this poor guy. So Cape Evans, the hut, is that was where this is. And I have this slide because this is the dive sites. Cape Evans Beach, Cape Evans Wall, that's where our experiments are. Little Razorback and Turtle Rock is where a lot of the seal footage comes. And then near McMurdo, I have a slide here from this southern tip. This is the metropolis of McMurdo. In the summer, population of about 1,000 people. And then these huts where we dive. Just to explain a little bit about diving, this is how we rig up the regulators. There's two independent valves, and that is because you have to have true redundancy in your regulators. A regulator is basically an on-demand valve that you put on your mouth, and when you suck on it, it opens the valve and it feeds you air. There's a membrane, and that membrane, if you get fresh water on it, it can freeze out and run free, and then you really lose your water, your air really, really quick. And so you have to turn this thing off, and your buddy turns this thing off, and then turns the other one on, and then you have enough time and enough air to get out. This is a thing that you practice. I never had to use it, but I practiced it many times. And it's a very interesting thing, is because it's very easy to pull the regulator out and to turn it off. But then to put the other one in, you have to sort of find the mouth first, because everything's numb. And so people stick their tongue out and put it around their tongue. And then the next trick is to actually have the strength in your facial muscles that are numb to open your mouth and wrap it around, which is a real effort. I don't know whether you ever had this experience, but it's really surprising at first. You know, with time, you can do it. It's no big deal, but it's really surprising at first. So this is Rob Robbins, the dive master, who I owe a lot, who helped me a lot diving and taught me a lot of things. And then this is Henry Kaiser, videographer, producer, and guitar player, who is a good friend and did pretty much all the video footage that you see today. So here's the dive hole, and here's how it looks from underneath. We have always a mooring in with an emergency air supply, so you don't have to decompress to get to some emergency air. And then there are loops for keeping your gear, but all the way down there are several strobes that flash so you can find your way back to the hole. This is Cape Evans Wall. You see the steep wall. That's where we... where our experiments are, because it's goes deep very quickly. And here's a glacier coming in. You can dive over to the steep ice wall underwater. It's really spectacular. And you see that there's a lot of snow on the ground, which means not much light comes into the ocean there. It's a south-facing exposure, which means it's always in the shade. So there's very little light Here's our experiments when we just put them out 5 years ago. That's 2 years later, and last year. So, and here's where we harvest them. We have like a box that we can seal where we can put these containers in and then bring them up without contamination as we leave the water. Now I'm going to show you a few slides that you'll see in part again in the movie, but I want to have a little time to explain what this is about. So this is near Cape Evans Hut. That's our diving hole with somebody's feet sticking out. Then you see that the ice on the underside is kind of brown, which means there's algae. Then you see these icicle things, which are really spectacular features. And what happens is that when seawater freezes, it's only the fresh part that freezes. And only 10-20% of the seawater freezes. The rest forms a brine between those crystals. Now, as your ice thickens, it rises. It's lighter, right? And then the brine drains out. The brine channelizes very quickly, but the brine is like at minus 50, 60 degrees C, and so as it enters the seawater, it's like acts like a coolant, and it freezes out the seawater and makes these icicles, right? And you can see that wherever these brinicles are, there's a lot of light, which means there are no algae growing. And so, you know, when you're diving, that looks like you have this huge area with recessed lighting, and it's really beautiful. These black spots are actually our air from diving. They just reflect the light from above away from you, and it appears black like the bottom of the ocean. This is the side of one of those brinicles, and you see these ice fish. You know, there's a little face there, a tail. They live in this open ice, and they eat bacteria that grow at this interface. So, needless to say, I was pretty intrigued by this, and we spent a lot of time around these brinicles. And in this case, you see that there's actually ice crystals forming on the bottom too. And physically, that seems not to make sense, because warm water is denser and sinks to the ground. There should nothing be growing down there. But what happens is that these brines actually sink to the ground and actually cool the ground as well, and then you get these big crystals here. So we took these photos and put them on the internet, and I get this call from Julian Cartwright from University of Granada, and he says, can I use your pictures? I'm writing a paper on the brinicles. And then a few months later, I ended up being the cover man on Langmuir magazine, which is a very reputable American Chemical Society publication. So that's the highlight of my career, to being sort of the pin-up on a scientific journal. So another impressive picture is the, you know, obviously land is on this side and it deepens there, and you see that there are these ridges here that are parallel to land, and what happens is that as ice grows, it expands and we have tidal heaves, and as a result the ice bunches up against land and it forms these ridges on the surface, and then in between there are these thin spots where the seals can go in and out. And these places allow seals to live through the winter in McMurdo at the southernmost latitude where any mammals exist. And again, we have the anchor ice here. Great place to dive. That's sort of an industrial site. That's the water intake for McMurdo, and we dive there, you know, partly for maintaining the water inlet, but also because it's actually a pretty cool spot. And for the first in decades, we found some dragonfish eggs. And if you look at them more closely, you can, you know, even imagine little dragonfish in there. Here's the grown-up version of this and a blow-up. And there seems to be some kind of comeback from these dragonfish. And then not so far south from there is Dayton's Wall, named after our own Dayton, Paul Dayton. And, you know, an amazing variety of sponges, and it's just like a garden. Another typical thing for the region are these volcano sponges that can be as tall as a person. They're hollow inside, and people have, you know, put themselves into it and had photographs taken, and somehow all these sponges died. And so this is off limit at this stage. Here's a Desmomela glaciale, which is an Antarctic jelly, and there will be quite a bit of footage of one of those. This guy is, you know, like almost not quite a foot in diameter, but that can be 2 or 3 feet. Now I'm going to show you a 5-minute video. And so it starts with a shot that you've seen before. I mean, it's a really impressive world down there to be there. And there's a bigger version of that movie on YouTube. If you just Google for my name, you'll find it. So see the size? So this guy got the vertical reference frame wrong. So this guy sort of swam down and got stuck on the ground. And but somehow he wasn't there the next day, and he found his way out. But right now it looks like he's gonna not make it. And as I said, all this footage is Henry Kaiser's, so I could be hands-free at all these occasions. So that's Dayton's Wall again. And when we were reviewing that footage, I realized that my inflator valve here was leaking. So I had to fix that. So I was losing a lot of air there. And that's right outside McMurdo. I mean, it's just, you know, we can see McMurdo from there. So you see that when you have a hole in sunshine, you know, it's like a spotlight, the air coming down, the light coming down. So I don't know whether you've seen seals on land, but they're so clumsy on land and so elegant underwater. So that's what it looks like from above, with these ridges in the ice. And then the sounds are actually seals. And so this guy obviously is responding to us, but since Henry was part of a seal team, he could take this footage. Normally we would have to go away. So that's a juvenile, a few weeks old. And it's just a dramatic landscape down there with, you know, these cloud-like things, the ground ice. See these big blades of ice. And then, so this is seal sound. So these are the volcano sponges. Again, you see some of them, you see the opening there where you can and shouldn't go in. So here's our And then here we go, back to the surface. Okay. Climbing. So, of course, when you go out, you train a lot, and so we're trying to climb up ropes and rappel down and first inside and then outside. So that's our team, Lori Connell, Brad Thiebaud, myself, and Roberto Anatori. And so this is our volcano, Erebus, with a trademark steam plume from the crater, and a crater rim, lava lake. And you see these red lava sort of opening up when the lava lake is turning over. A little bit of weather, that's a lenticular cloud that typically form when the weather gets bad and you better get into a place where you can survive it. That was a storm we had, 80, 90 miles an hour winds and minus 60, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, so it was not pleasant out there. And then this really stiff wind basically drives snow everywhere. So I had my hot flip-flops next to the door, and I kind of got snowed in the process. So, but you know, we have a hut, and we can very comfortable in there. So, this is a hydrothermal field, and these are all steam vents. You know, many of you may have seen those things in Hawaii, and if you would put Hawaii in the deep freeze, that's what you would get, right? So the ice, the water will immediately freeze out and make these chimneys. These are relatively small. And like this one is like 10, 20 centimeters diameter, up to a meter tall. And you see from this debris here that those things constantly grow and collapse and regrow and collapse and regrow. They're unstable features. And those features can get bigger and bigger. And this in particular, this is our mountaineer, Alistair Turner, and you see these blocks here, which tells you that that thing grew after this one collapsed, right? So all these things are very dynamic systems, and one of your goals is not to get entrained in one of those collapses, because that is not very good. So you end up climbing up here, and there's a hole in there, and then you know you see that's about 6 feet, so that's like 30 feet down. So you rappel down into this hole, and you look back up, and that's the chimney from inside looking up. And it's just you know, beautiful ice formations that you find in these caves. And you will notice, and this one is the slide that I showed in the beginning, you'll notice that there's a lot of light. And I told you before that we're not going to work where there's light. But the idea was that we found in one cave contamination from human presence. And so NSF asked us to do a systematic survey of all the caves to see the state of their contamination. And shucks, you know, we have to go into all these caves. You know, just, so what a chore. So we sampled those and got, this is an entry to one. This is like 8 feet high, so you can just walk into this one, and there you you see these spans is pretty high. You know, there's a bit of pressure that pushes this down on you, and it's not surprising that those things every now and then collapse. So it's just, you know, it's just very photogenic. You know, those little red things are our temperature probes where we monitor temperature for a long time. This is hoarfrost. So this is the size of the palm of your hand. And you see these crystals, and it's just beautiful to look at. These are some icicles that have melted, and then you have crystals growing on top of the icicle later on. Here, sort of, you can see there's a pretty steep, it goes steeply down, and I'm working here with infrared camera to identify the hot spots, because you don't want to put your hands in, because you don't want to contaminate it. So we are mapping out these caves and sample these hydrothermal sediments. This is Alistair Turner, our mountaineer, and most of the work in the end was him and me. The other guys had to sort of leave or had a problem health-wise. It's altitude is a real problem up there. So this is an inconspicuous looking cave, but that's our main cave where we work. And here's a map of it. So here's the entrance, and here's where we're standing taking the photograph. So we were more or less above this chamber. So again, you have to move very carefully and see where you go, that you don't become part of a cave collapse. And then we put our experiments over here. So that's entering the cave. No big deal. You know, you basically rappel in. One thing that's important here is we use a shovel here to stabilize the edge so the rope doesn't cut into the ice, which makes it easier to get out. Because once you have the rope in the ice, you cannot make it across that lip. It's very hard. But the way down is not very straight down, so there's always some places where the rope digs in. But down is easy. But then going up is the other thing. You know, basically you have this rope coming up, and you are tied to it with a sender by your harness, and with a sender with one of those loops. You push your way up, and then you move your ascender from your body up, and then you relax into that rope, and then you move this up, and then you push yourself up with your legs. So it can be done. When I do this, it's not far from elegant, but we can do this. It's a bit of effort, but fun. So that's down in the cave with our sampling gear. The first hydrothermal system that we worked on, it's like a 40 degrees C, and you see the rock is all stained red from the fumes. This is sort of a typical exposure experiment that we have, and you see the ground actually steaming there. So I promised you to give you some results from our microbiological work, and the Ascomycota is one phylum in the family, in the kingdom of the fungi. And we find two in this, and then a series of others. And the same with, you know, another phylum. So there's a fair number of fungi in this system. And I don't want to get into great detail, partly because I'm not a biologist myself, and partly because it just would be an entire talk. Now, this is the same thing for the bacteria. And you see there's only the dominant one is one group, the actinobacteria. And then a little less are the acidobacteria. And then everything else is less than 10%. So the fungi are very diverse. The bacteria are not very diverse. So now one of the things that we are interested in when we're looking at these microbes is that how do they actually fix carbon, right? I mean, that's the big question. The relevance of the deep biosphere is given only if it produces enough stuff that it actually plays a role in a large scale in biomass and producing, you know, more or less being the rock bottom of the food chain. So we looked at different mechanisms of autotrophic carbon fixation. So there's four different cycles that we explored, but the only one that gave us results is that we got Rubisco, which is the Calvin cycle. So all these do not play a role in our case. So very simple one type of carbon fixation. Now, Rubisco is something that you can treat like you can treat DNA, where you actually analyze a DNA and you figure out how similar one DNA is to the other, and then you can construct a phylogenetic tree. And in a phylogenetic tree, what happens is that the ones that are closest to each other are like right neighboring branches, and the ones that are very different from each other are on very different branches, right? So with these trees, you can figure out who is related to what, and you can figure out, you know, this bifurcation has to happen before this one, and this one has to happen before that one. And so this split between those two groups is a split that happened relatively early. So that's the basic rules of how to interpret these diagrams. So what we have two types of Rubisco, green type and red type. And these names came about because people started doing this work in the oceans, and the Rubisco that associate with green algae is this, the Rubisco associate with the red algae is this, right? So the color coding. Now the brown and the green is what has been known before we did this analysis. And I should say this analysis is done by Rick Davis in Brad Thiebaud's lab, and that's his data, and he is allowing me to show them to you. It's not published yet. So in blue are all the types of Rubisco that he identified in our caves. So let's figure out where they fall. None of them are in the green, right? They're all sort of dark red algae type Rubisco. And, you know, just the sheer number, there's one study. One study has almost as much as all the previous studies together, right? There's a lot of new stuff there. We have a very novel community with very diverse Rubisco, diverse mechanisms of fixing carbon, which is in contrast with the very low diversity we find in the bacteria. And so these ctenobacteria, if they are the carriers and the producer of the Rubisco, they must be very clever in tailoring and using all kinds of different Rubiscos that do various tasks. Now, when you're looking at the similarity of these Rubiscos, you will see that a lot of our Rubiscos are deeply rooted, like this one is down here, then this one is down there. So we are also looking at a relatively early type of Rubisco, okay? And so that's where I want to leave you, and thank you for your attention. Yeah, I couldn't see it. Go ahead.
Rubisco, is that a type of microbe? Is a Rubisco a type of microbe?
No, it's a gene. It's a gene that is part of the Calvin cycle of fixing carbon, right? It's very specific to carbon fixation in the Calvin cycle. So that gene has a complex structure, very much like DNA, but that allows you to sort of identify the Rubisco that is relatively early or something that was formed later. Yeah, go ahead.
I have two questions.
Oh, of course.
First question, when you were diving,
yeah,
how long can you stay in that frigid water? Can you repeat the question?
Okay, the question is how long we can stay down in underwater in the very cold water. The water is like -3-4 Celsius. And how long we stay there, I mean, I'm not a very experienced diver, so I'm an air hog. So if we dive deep, right, when you use up under higher pressure more water, more air, I'll stay 15, 20 minutes. And if I shallow, 30, 35 minutes. But the beauty is that you don't have to stay long, right? You have these comfortable huts that are heated. You come out and have a sandwich. Spend a half hour to 45 minutes talking, and then you go back down. bring enough bottles, and you're good to go.
Second question.
The question was, what kind of contamination we find in those caves, and human-introduced. And the specifics that we find is rice. We find Weddell seal. And tobacco products.
And
we don't know what. We don't say what. What the interesting thing about the seals is that this particular cave is in direct line between the summit of Mount Erebus and the last camp of the summit team that Shackleton sent up there. So it's actually possible that they walked in there with their seal fur boots and left some seal hair behind. But I mean, that's kind of a speculation. But it was kind of cool that people just had identified the location of this historical site where they had their camp, and you know, draw, it's like a beeline straight up to the, and that's the way I would go. And if there's and these caves, particularly the ones that are easy to get into, they're a fantastic place to seek shelter. I mean, it's very warm in there, there's no wind, and you want to be there. I mean, it's too cold and too windy out there, and you can go in there and have a smoke and eat your lunch. I mean, I would have done this, and I didn't have a smoke, but it's nice to not, you know, not to have. Oh, and we also found dandruff, so hat up. So
we're about out of time, but I want to thank you all very much for coming and join me in thanking Hubert for a fascinating talk.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.